Greetings and welcome back to our continued series of the study of the Book of Ruth, Gilat Rut. And today we are going to finish our study of the second chapter, Perek Bet. And as such, we will speed up the pace a little bit. Next week there should be three podcasts taking us to the middle of chapter 4, and then before the Festival of Shavuot, we will have the final one or two sessions to complete the book in anticipation of the holiday and the public reading of Ruth on Shavuot. In the last podcast, we went through the bulk of the second chapter and the dialogue between Boaz and Ruth and the special rights that Ruth was given in the field by Boaz. And now we are at verse 17, Pasuk Yod Zayin. Vatalake pasadem ad ha'arev. Before going any further, I'd like to point out a phenomenon which is prevalent throughout the Tanakh. It's prevalent throughout the Bible. It is one that the earliest of our commentators noted, but never formulaically, never programmatically, and only really in the last century or so has it attained some sort of formal status. And that is the notion of a leitvort, or a keyword, or as it's called in Hebrew, mila mancha, which, looking throughout narratives and legal passages and passages of poetry and psalms, etc., one can with relatively ease, usually discern a key word or a key phrase, or sometimes there are two or three different words that show up with either great overabundance, or they're relatively rare words that show up, and usually they show up seven times or some multiple of seven. So as an example, in Exodus 31, the section about Shabbat, the word Shabbat, Shin Bet Tav, shows up seven times. In the inauguration of Moses at the bush, Moses' name shows up 14 times. In the inauguration of Samuel, in 1 Samuel chapter 3, Paragimel of Shmuel Aleph, Samuel's name shows up 21 times. And this is often the style used by Tanakh, but not exclusively. As an example, Professor Yehuda Elitzur pointed out that the key word in Joshua 3 and 4, which leads to the use of a relatively rare word in Joshua 5, is avar, la'avor, to pass. Now, to pass is used something like 30-plus times. It is not exactly a multiple of 7, but it's just used so many times. It's clearly the key word. And the purpose of a key word is to indicate what the underlying theme of that particular passage is. In some cases, it's fairly obvious, like the inauguration of a particular prophet, so that prophet perhaps the focus of the inauguration. Although in Moses' case, it is somewhat surprising because we think the focus of the stand at the bush is the liberation of the Israelites, not Moses' inauguration. And in some cases, it's somewhat surprising. The key word in the first chapter of Ruth was clearly Lashuv, to return. And the entire tension of which direction to return, are you going to return back to Moab, are you going to return with Ruth to Yehuda, is really the constant tension of the chapter, pulls in different directions. Interestingly enough, the root, Shuv, to return, appears 12 times in the chapter. Indeed, if we look at it in Megillat Ruth, we find that the number 12, or shall we say multiples of 6, show up in all sorts of places. Boaz's name, I believe, is mentioned 18 times. Naomi's name is mentioned 12 times. Ruth's name is also mentioned, I believe, 18 times. They're all mentioned a multiple of 6. It doesn't mean anything. For right now, we'll leave it as just being some sort of a common method, as opposed to having any symbolic meaning. Perhaps in chapter 3, we will talk about it as having significant meaning, as associated with a later hero who is the outgrowth of this Megillah. But when we look at chapter 2, it's interesting that the key word is lelaket, and that's why I'm talking about it now, because it is the beginning of our first verse, vatelaket, she collected, and the verb lelaket, lamed kuf tet, to collect, which is the technical term for the gift to the poor left when the harvester drops seeds, he shows up also 12 times in this chapter. And the reason for that seems to be, first of all, that the entire focus of the chapter is about the leket, about the collection, and the diligence with which Ruth did her work at collecting. But it's also something else, that there is a greater collection that's happening here, sort of a meta collection, which is that Ruth is being brought together with Boaz. And just as Boaz's workers drop seeds and Ruth picks them up, similarly, Boaz is dropped here and Ruth is dropped there, and Ruth happens to walk into Boaz's field, and then suddenly they're brought together and ultimately leading to their union, which will lead to a much greater gathering among Am Yisrael. So just something to note. In the next chapter, we will discuss the significance of the number 6 within the context of Megillat Ruth and later Jewish history. In any case, she collected in the field all the way until evening. Now this itself, of course, is absolutely remarkable, because when you see somebody working till the very end of the day, we fully expect that during harvest season, that the harvesters are working full-time and maximizing daylight. Start at the crack of dawn and work till the end of the day, because there's a lot of harvesting to be done, and it must be done while things are fresh. And if, thankfully, the field is plentiful and the crop is abundant, then there is much to collect, and without modern machinery, it does take a lot of time and a lot of work. However, it is absolutely remarkable to find a poor person who is a collector staying there all the way until evening, especially when she already evidently had more than enough by midday and was sitting down having lunch, but she didn't then leave or sit and relax for the rest of the day. She got up and collected till the evening, and this substantiates and fortifies our impression of her as a very diligent person, someone who we would not normally associate chronic poverty. Vatachbot et asher liketa, so she collected everything that she put together, everything she collected. Vayhi ke'efas se'orim. And how much was it? So we're told that it's an efa, which is something along the lines of 30 kilograms. This is a huge amount of barley for her to have collected, a lot of seeds, and evidently an efa, which also means a basket. As an example in the book of Zechariah, an efa is a basket, but here it also is a measure, as it shows up in the Torah as a measure, and an efa is 10 omarim, or shall we say an omer, as we see in the last verse in chapter 16 of Exodus, when describing the man, the manna, an omer is 1/10 of an efa, asirita efa. And so this is 10 omarim, and that's how much barley she's got, which is, again, an astounding amount, way more than is needed for the day or even the week. Now, by the way, what could you do with that barley if not yourself to eat it, which, by the way, for the most part, people don't like to eat barley or things made out of barley, if they can avoid it, is it can be sold, it can be traded for other things. So she really is thinking beyond just the immediate sustenance. So what did she do? She carried it. She's a strong woman. She carried this big bundle or big basket, and she came to the city. Now, we have to walk back. We've done this before, to walk into Boaz's shoes and walk in Ruth's shoes to see how they view each other and how they view how the other one views them. But now we've got to go back to Naomi. Naomi's been at home all day. Naomi, seemingly with apathy, said to Ruth in the morning, go ahead. If you want to go collect, bakasha, go ahead. And now she's going to come back at the end of the day. You've got to imagine Naomi's somewhat surprised or somewhat alarmed. Where has Ruth been all day? Ruth went out to find a field. Maybe she did, maybe she didn't, but to be gone all day is quite a bit. What's the first thing Naomi sees? Naomi sees what Ruth had collected. She sees this huge basket. What's her first impression? And this is somewhat surprising, because attribute ignorance of the law to Ruth is not surprising at all. She's a Moabite. How would she know that she has rights in the field? But to attribute the same sort of ignorance to Naomi means one of two things. It either means that she once knew and she forgot, or else it means that she never knew. Now, as the wife of a wealthy landowner, and we would assume that there were always some poor around Beit Lechem, which means that during harvest season she would be used to seeing the poor coming, we would expect that she would have known that the poor had such a right. But evidently she didn't, or she had forgotten. In a few minutes we will see Naomi's surprise. So what did Naomi do? She took out, you know, she had this big basket, and it means she took out, evidently for a pouch or a pocket or something, she took out those toasted kernels that she had left over from her full meal. She had a full meal at lunch, and then she kept the rest of the kernels, and that's what she gave Naomi for dinner. Vatomer lachamota, now there's a play on words here, a folikatayom va'ana asit. Now Naomi comes to life. For the first time since she's been in Beit Lechem, she says more than two words. Beforehand, she was bitter to the other people. She didn't talk to Ruth. To Ruth, all she could say that morning was, "Go, my daughter." Now suddenly she speaks up. Efoli katayom ve'anasit. Where did you collect today? Again. And where did you do all of this work? Yehi makirech baruch. Now there's a very interesting play on words here, but we'll get to it in a second. Yehi makirech baruch. Naomi is saying the one who favored you, the one who recognized you, should be blessed. She is blessing Boaz without knowing who Boaz is, meaning without knowing that it is Boaz. She is blessing whoever it is that granted Ruth such rights. Now this goes back to what I was talking about 3 minutes ago. That clearly, evidently, Naomi does not know that Ruth has a right to come into the field, and thinks that whoever let her come into the field was being generous and with great largesse, opening up his field to her. That demonstrates some lack of knowledge on her part as to the rights, her rights in the field. And she blesses him. Now the play on words is as follows. If you recall in the conversation, we looked at the last podcast, the conversation that takes place between Boaz and Ruth. In verse 10, she says, "Madua matzati chen b'reinecha lahakireini." Why have you? Why have I found favor in your eyes that you favor me, that you recognize me, that you single me out? And that's the exact word that Naomi uses here. Yehim makirech baruch, the one that has favored you, that has singled you out, that has recognized you, should be blessed. Now again, there is a little bit of an alliteration within the text, makirech baruch, the resh and the chaf. But besides that, the text puts the same word in Naomi's mouth that was in Ruth's mouth towards Boaz face to face. And again, the text is tying together Naomi and Boaz, almost, if you will, as co-parents or co-guardians of Ruth, where they both call her BT, and they have this word makir, and Ruth seems to be here and later on something of a go-between, pulled between the two of them. And so that relationship is somewhat established, not a relationship between Naomi and Boaz, but a parallel relationship between Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. And now, what happened? She asked her who he was. Vatagid l'chamota. The first thing she told her mother-in-law, Eit asher astayimo. She told her everything that happened. Told her all of the work she did. Vatomer. And then she said, Shem ha'ish asher asiti imo hayom, Boaz. The man who, in whose field I did all this work is Boaz. Now this, the next reaction of Naomi and Ruth's evident ignorance to this indicates that Ruth really was not aware at all that Boaz was in any way related or had some former relationship of friendship or acquaintance to her family. And Boaz never let on, because Ruth says it as if, oh, by the way, the guy's name is Boaz. That's the guy who did it. What's Naomi's reaction? She says, Vatomer lo Naomi, sorry, Vatomer Naomi lechalata. What does she say to her daughter-in-law? Baruch Hu Adonai. Now she blesses him. Now that she knows who he is, he's blessed to God. Asher lo azav chasto et achayim et hametim. Now the word asher here is equivocal and deliberately so. Asher lo azav chasto, who has not abandoned his kindness from the living and the dead. Who is she talking about? Notice she says, when she hears that Boaz is the name, is the man in whose field Ruth collected, she says, he is blessed to God, who has not abandoned his kindness. Who has not abandoned his kindness? God or Boaz? The answer is both. God has maintained his kindness both with the living and the dead. We'll have to see how God has maintained his kindness with the dead. And that will only happen, we'll only see that really at the end of the Megillah. But with the living, God has arranged for you to come into the field of somebody who is our relative and who feels he has a debt towards us, etc. And somebody who's a kind person. And indeed, Boaz has also maintained kindness of the living and the dead. How has Boaz maintained kindness of the living? That's easy. But how has Boaz maintained kindness with the dead? Because it is his relationship with those who are no longer here that has spurred him to do this. Good. So Asher lo azav chasto is referring both to Boaz and to Hashem. And then, Vatomer la Naomi, now Naomi, after giving this beautiful blessing, and by the way, notice, Naomi was willing to bless him when she didn't know who he was, and when she found out who he was, give him another blessing. As if to say, that blessing, perhaps, there's a whole new wrinkle to the blessing when I know who it is that I'm talking about. Vatomer la Naomi. And now Naomi tells her, Karov lanu ha'ish mi go'aleinu hu. Karov lanu ha'ish means he is close to us, but it means he's a relative. Mi go'aleinu hu. Now this term is a critical term, and in the fourth chapter is going to be one of the key words. And the word is go'el. The word go'el means a redeemer. But the word go'el in Tanakh, in the Bible, also means a relative, because it is the relative's responsibility to redeem his kin. And that redemption takes primarily two forms, and then there's a third ancillary form. The ancillary form is one that many people are familiar with, and that is the notion of the Goel Hadam. If a family member has been killed, then the blood vengeance is something that's the responsibility or the right, unclear, of a member of the family. But that's ancillary to what we're talking about. Geula appears in the Tanakh explicitly in the context of Geulat Karka, redeeming land. If a person is impoverished and is forced to sell his ancestral land, his relatives are obligated to come and buy it and redeem it and keep it in the family and ultimately find some way to get it back to him. And therefore, the family member is called a Goel. And this is found in this week's Parsha, in Parsha Bahar, in Leviticus 25, Uva Goalo, Akarom Elav, his Goel, who was close to him, which, by the way, demonstrates that the closer the person is, the higher up he is in the hierarchy of redeemers, which means that a brother is a redeemer before an uncle is a redeemer, etc. And therefore, our son perhaps is the first redeemer. And therefore, when Naomi says, Karov lanu ha'ish mi goaleinu hu, he is one of our goalim, what she is implying there is he is on our list of family redeemers, if you will, but he is not number one on the list, which will set up the entire tension of the second half of the third chapter and the beginning of the fourth chapter about that first person on the list. Now, it's important to note, and this we're going to spend a lot more time on this in chapter 4, but actually in chapter 3, but the other component of Geula is one not related to land, but related to legacy. And it plays out as follows. In the ancient world, and there's a critical difference between the ancient world and the modern world. The modern world is essentially existential. We all are concerned about our own personal existence. And one could argue that there's quite a bit of narcissism involved in that. The ancient world was much more tribal. The ancient world throughout was much more tribal. The concern in a family was not about the existence of the individual, but the continuity of the family. And the continuity of the family, or the continuity of the individual, as if to say, to continue living beyond the grave, was expressed in two manners. It was expressed by the continuity of maintaining presence and ownership over the same plot of land. As an example, look in the first book of Kings, chapter 21, Melachim Aleph Perek Chaf Aleph, in the story of Navot HaYisraeli and his refusal to sell his vineyard even to the king, because God forbid he should ever abandon his ancestral land. It was by the continuity of being on the same land as my father and my grandfather and my great-grandfather, and having my son and my grandson and my great-grandson continue to till that land and reap the produce, that immortality is achieved. And of course, the second component of that immortality is through children. And as such, the Torah places a tremendous premium on that kind of continuity, such that it lifts the prohibition of marrying a brother's wife, which is otherwise an erva, is otherwise a violation of sexual liaisons, lifts that if the brother did not have children, and enforces the mitzvah of yibum, of the levirate marriage, for the purpose of Shelo Yimachesh from Yisrael, that his name should not be blotted out. That even though he didn't have children, there should be children that are sort of part of his family, because his wife marries the brother, and that, therefore they have children, and the first child that's born stands instead of that father, and the continuity is assured. This is where redemption comes in, and that's why a relative who has that responsibility is called a Goel, and that's why Naomi turns to Ruth and points out and says, mi goalenu. He is one of our goalim, but of course not the first. Now, Vatomer Ruth HaMoavia, what does Ruth say back? And again, the text is expressing that she's an outsider, which means that the the notion, the new information that Boaz is a goel, nonetheless is set off by the fact that Ruth is distant. She's a Moaviah. Gam ki amar elai im ha'ne'arim asher li tibakin. So Ruth almost has to say, oh, now I understand it, because I now understand what he said to me, that you should stay with my young men. In other words, he wants me to come back and be there every day during the harvest season. Adim kilu et kol ha'katzir asher li, until they finish the entire harvest. So as Ruth is telling Naomi that not only did Boaz allow me to be in the field all day and gave me this food and allowed me to drink and everything she told him, but he said he wants me to come back and to stay with the harvesters throughout the season. So what's Naomi's response to that? Batomer Naomi el Ruth Kalata. Now she says to Ruth, and no, it's not Ruth HaMoaviyah, it's Ruth Kalata, not Ruth the Moabite, but Ruth, her daughter-in-law. Tov biti. Okay, good, my daughter. Hitetzim na'arotav. Notice, Na'arim and Na'arot, the young men and the young women, are all mixed up together here. In Ruth's words, it was stay with the young men. And here it's stay with the, go to the young women. V'lo yifku ubach b'sadeh acher. Don't go get bothered in another field. Don't go to another field. Do exactly what Boaz said. Again, tying Naomi to Boaz as parallel caretakers of Ruth. That exactly what Boaz told Ruth to do is Naomi substantiates, says do that exact thing. That to stay in his field, not to go anywhere else. So what did Ruth do? She did exactly that. She stayed with Boaz as Na'arot. Ad klod k'tzir ha-se'orim u'k'tzir ha-chitim. Now we jump ahead. So a little bit about the agricultural calendar in Eretz Yisrael, at least as described in the Tanakh. As we know, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, is noted for its grain, for its olives, for its grapes. And there are several other noteworthy pieces of produce, and dates, and figs, and pomegranates, and of course, when we speak about wheat, we all speak about barley. The agricultural season that is envisioned, at least in Tanakh, works as follows. The barley ripens at the end of the winter, the beginning of the spring. And that's why the first offering that is brought on the second day of Pesach, which is an omer, is an omer's worth of barley. Subsequent to that, from the middle of May until around the end of June or so, is the wheat harvest. It depends on the year, but is the wheat harvest. And thus, Shavuot, which is 7 weeks later, involves an offering of 2 loaves of wheat bread. During the summer, the other fruits are harvested, which is figs and dates, and later in the summer, grapes and pomegranates. And in the beginning of the fall, and sometimes as late as late fall, olives are harvested. And that's pretty much the season. The reason that's important is the barley season goes directly into the, or leads into the wheat harvest. So Ruth stayed with Boaz, and she harvested his barley, and then she harvested his wheat. Now that tells us something that we didn't know before, that Boaz has both barley and wheat. And we would fully expect that after he harvested the barley, the next thing he would do would be to thresh the barley. But indeed, that's not the case. He harvests the barley, and the next thing that he does is to harvest the wheat, and she stays in the field the entire time. By the way, the barley has not yet been harvested. So a couple notes about the coming chapter. The coming chapter takes place over the course of one night. It takes place in the granary. It starts at Naomi's home, it ends at Naomi's home, but most of the chapter takes place on the floor of the granary during the middle of the night. This is taking place, as we see from sequence, after the end of the wheat harvest. And what is Boaz doing in the granary? Boaz is there to thresh the barley. Why is he threshing the barley? Why didn't he thresh the barley a month and a half ago when he finished harvesting it? So this is where Tanakh, the study of Tanakh, is aided in no small measure by knowledge of many, many other disciplines. And in this case, something about agriculture or agronomics. And that is that barley, after it is harvested, needs to be dried out. You can't thresh it when it's wet. So evidently you harvest the barley and then bundle it and then bring it into the granary and let it sit there and dry out for perhaps a month, 2 months. And only then do you come and thresh it and winnow it. And so that's what Boaz is doing. And we now find ourselves moving very quickly from the beginning of the spring to the beginning of the summer. We've gone through the entire harvest season and Ruth has stayed in Boaz's field. Now, another note about where we've gotten to. as I pointed out a couple of sessions ago, the first chapter, and this is a point that David Nativ made in a small article in a book, El Asher Telchi Elech, in the first chapter of Rut, takes place over the course of, we'll call it conservatively 13 years, but it's very likely more than that. It also takes place over, let's call it 100 miles, from Beit Lechem to Moab and back to Beit Lechem. And it involves a dramatic change. This Nativ does not point out. It involves a dramatic change in the cast. The cast starts out with three men and a woman, a man, a wife, and his two sons, and their two sons. It ends with a woman and two other women, and only one of them is a holdover from the original cast. Three of the original cast members are dead, Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion, and the other two cast members who show up at the end of chapter one are new to the story, and one of them disappears, so all we've got left now is two women. And by the way, notice another difference. Chapter one begins with a predominantly male cast with one woman. Now we've got just two women. Chapter one begins with a wealthy family leaving Israel. Chapter two shows up with two single women coming back to Eretz Israel. Chapter one begins with, I say chapter one, chapter one. Chapter one begins with people who are leaving with great wealth. Chapter one ends with the people returning in great poverty. And that this change is almost underscored by the very alarmed reaction of the women in Beit Lechem, who say, Hazot Naomi, could this really be Naomi? And Naomi herself says, give me a different name. Call me Mara. So that's chapter one. Chapter one takes place over a wide geographic spectrum relative to the rest of the book. It takes place over a wide temporal spectrum of 12, 13, 14, maybe 15, maybe even more years, because there's at least 10 years, which is after there's the exile, and then there's the death of Elimelech, and then there's the marriage of Machlon and Kilion, and they're married for 10 years, and they die, and only afterwards they return. So again, we've called it 12 or 13 years conservatively. And it takes place over a wide range of changes within who is our cast and who they are and what they look like. Chapter 2 is much, much more defined. Chapter 2 takes place over, we'll call it 3 months, the harvest season. It takes place with the same two people and a third person added in. Ruth and Naomi are at the beginning, Ruth and Naomi are at the end, and in the middle there's Boaz. The other people don't have names because they are foils. They're not significant. The harvesters, the other workers, the supervisor, they're not significant in and of themselves, but just as people, as players to play the role. It also takes place in a very limited geographic area, which is within the confines of Beit Lechem, from city to field, back to city. And if you think about it, city to field, back to city every day over the course of those 3 months, but it's a narrow geographic area. Take a look at chapter 3. Chapter 3 takes place over the course of one very long night, from the beginning of the evening until dawn. So it's much more limited. It also takes place really with only three characters that we already know. There are no other characters here. It's Ruth and Naomi, and Ruth and Boaz, and Ruth and Naomi. And it takes place now in a much more defined area, which is in one building on the floor of the threshing floor of Boaz. And then the fourth chapter, at least the critical scene, the fourth chapter is going to take place over the course of perhaps an hour. It's going to take place in one very, very limited place, which is the court. And so the text seems to be moving us from broad to narrow, from scattered to compact, and that may indeed be also set up by the fact that the text introduces itself as Vayhi b'mei Shvot HaShoftim. It happened in the times of the Shoftim, the chieftains, which was a period of tribalism and of disunion, and the very last word in the Megillah is David, because this Megillah points us really to the bridge from tribalism to monarchy, from a loose federation of people to a united monarchy under David. Just an interesting point about the structure of the text and perhaps what it tells us about the role of David, etc. What we're going to do in the next podcast is we'll take a look at the first half of chapter 3 and perhaps even most of chapter 3. And Mitzvah Hashem, we will be able to do that on Monday or on Tuesday. And I want to wish everyone a wonderful Shabbat. If you listen to this after Shabbat, then a Shavua Tov. And we should all have hear wonderful news and experience strength and enjoyment from our Limud HaTorah.